My name's Kyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Kyle.
All the contraptions are on and set. Right? We're good. This feels very official. I feel like I need to do like the official thing that I hear people do where they say, my sobriety date is April 27, 1997. I have a sponsor and I have a home group, which I don't remember the name. It's like the one that Miles goes to. It's like on Sunday nights at 8 near Piedmont Ave at some church, and I do coffee for that group. It's called How It Works. Yeah, thank you. This whole like being recorded thing is interesting. I remember my first meetings were deep in the hood of Trenton, New Jersey. I grew up in a town right outside of Trenton, New Jersey, and called Princeton, New Jersey, where the university is. So the meetings, they would record, but it was really interesting. It was a different style of recovery of AA. I mean, this was the 80s, the crack epidemic 80s in inner cities. And so it was wild times, you know, and even in AA meetings, like, you know, you had people with like the AA emblem in their tooth, you know, gold tooth emblems. You had people making mixtapes and selling mixtapes of speakers just like right outside, like straight up. It was just like chaotic and dramatic, and I loved it because I was only 17 years old. And when I went to like the AA meetings in my town of Princeton, it was like super boring to me. Everyone felt like old, and you know, like I just didn't feel like I fit in immediately. And of course, coming with that like disease of isolation and not wanting to identify, you know, it felt like my life was about to be over as soon as I walked in the door, you know. I remember when I first picked up my first drink, the stage of it was I was super insecure as an eighth grader whose father who had left us, and I had a lot of anger and no real coping abilities, never really learned that you could share your feelings. I remember one time I told my dad I was afraid of like ghosts. And I was crying. I think it scared him. I don't think he knew how to deal with the, you know, like it is kind of scary when like a child is like, just go, you know, like all the horror movies are like some, you know, possessed child, right? So like, and so he seemed like he was kind of, so, you know, he just got really upset with me and punished me. So I didn't know how to have feelings, you know, and have my feelings, you know, so when I didn't know how to let him out in any positive way. So when I felt like I was never good enough, I never handsome enough, you know, all these kinds of things. And so I remember, I never felt like I fit into the social, you know, fabric of my community or whatever. And then when I picked up my first drink, all that went away. All that crazy, you know, anxiety and over analysis and all that, it just erased. And I felt like I could be for the first time. And that was my first sort of like next level spiritual experience. My first addiction and spiritual experience was definitely in the Nintendo Entertainment System. Mario was like crack. But anyway, but, you know, in terms of one that would sort of like, you know, allow me to, you know, get through puberty, you know, it was alcohol, right? And so it was just doing that, and that became the priority, and school was less important and morals were less important. And I began, you know, as a young person, we didn't have any money, so I would steal and rob people to get what I needed to get, you know. And then it was just like, what did I do last night when I was under the influence, embarrassed and ashamed of violent or insulting things that I had done to, you know, to people, and then just drinking to erase that shame, right? And then that spiral continues. And I would like to just sort of focus on some of the more shameful things. It's important for me to say, like, I've done some things that I really hated myself for doing, you know, and it took being in recovery and learning that, like, it's okay. I can have this pass and let go of it through a fourth and fifth step, you know, that I was able to sort of like get to a point where like I feel like I can look eye to eye with anyone, you know. But at the time, I felt like I was like the worst person in the world for doing things like physically attacking and robbing and mugging my own mother to get money from her wallet. Completely bullying all my brother and his friends to steal and rob money and alcohol from all of their liquor cabinets. College students who were on campus, and we would gang up on them, and it would get very violent, and sometimes I would black out, and I even blacked out to the point where I woke up at times in cars with blood, and I had no idea where it came from. And these were things that I just felt like I would never be able to forgive myself for, you know, especially when it came to my mother, who was working three jobs to try to maintain, you know, food on the table, you know. When I finally got sober, and it was interesting, I mean, it was 17, so it's not finally, right? But at the same time, it was like, for me, I really tried everything, you know, to keep my alcohol addiction alive. I tried all the things I talk about in there, you know, and I remember it just felt how could this comes from a plant, right? Like, how could that beat me? I'm human. Like, all these different ways of thinking that I should be able to beat this thing, and it just got to a point where I was so in over my head, and I hated myself so much. I needed to do something different, and I was very fortunate that my mother hooked up a situation to get me into a rehab in a time when, unless you had a lot of money or you had a suicide attempt, you couldn't get into rehabs as an adolescent, right? She worked miracles in order to get me into a rehab and in order to get me a counselor, right? A lot of young people around that age come in, most don't stay. It's sort of a special situation, right? I was at school and everyone wanted to, like, everyone that I knew was either a drug dealer or like someone who wanted to beat me up from something that I did wrong the other way. And I got death threats at school, and I had to drop out and get my GED, or as Chris Rock says, good enough diploma. You know, my mother had no money and went up to like the most bougie $300 a week therapist, you know what I'm saying, or addiction specialist in our town, and said, I have no money. You're going to see my son twice a week. And later on, she said it was like a Jedi mind trick, and she just like said, yes, you know, and she did, you know, and became a huge mentor. And I started going to, you know, after I got out of rehab for 25 days, I did a lot of meetings, and I hated it. You know, I just felt like I was 17 going on 50, right? Let's go to the diner, you know, all these things. It's like, you know, and I had messages on my phone. I decided I wasn't going to hang out with my old friends, which was my own identity, and they all called me a snitch, and I was afraid to go home. And I remember getting calls. One was like snitch death threats, and the other was like, yo, you should have been at this party, what are you up to? And I'm thinking to myself, what am I up to? I'm like talking about my feelings to my sponsor, going to Blockbuster Video and working, and that was when it was like really popping too. And going to a meeting a day, you know, doing like real grown-up shit, you know, and I hated it. And I remember going to this one sort of old timer who was like my sponsor, and he said, you know, I know it sucks. And he said, listen, he's like, let it suck. Just like, it's okay for it to suck sometimes. Just let it suck. And that was some of the best advice I ever got. I did. I just let it suck for a while. What time is mine over?
Yeah, 3 minutes.
Oh, nice. I started doing things, you know, in terms of recovery, like they said, like, you know, like go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, like I had the sponsor, I was working the steps. I had a commitment, you know, we called it dashboard recovery because, like, you know, I had my little car and I would always pick somebody up and drive them, and we'd talk, you know, behind, you know, talk about, you know, recovery stuff or whatever. And I started enjoying hanging out with these old people because I had some self-esteem. I was doing cool things. My mother had her son back all of a sudden, and we were reading bedtime stories, you know what I'm saying? And it was just this beautiful 180. And I got to go to community college and then go to Rutgers University. I got to graduate, and my mother got to see me graduate, you know, and throw me a graduation party. Create my own business and stay connected and go through heartbreaks. And then my mother passed away of cancer, and you know, she got to see her son sober and be by her bedside and be the strength for her family. And my little brother, I got to teach him how to drive, and I get to go through life like with all the successes and failures, and you can't take those things away from me, you know. And I don't like, you can't take those like spiritual like moments that I've had that are super powerful and important, you know, being there for friends when they've lost loved ones, you know, being able to show up for young people, you know, in a way, because I know what it's like to be in that, you know. I'm blessed, like, you know, I have shitty days, you know, I fall off on my character defects sometimes, you know, but like, it's like, I have this opportunity to get right back on track and check in with my sponsor. And it's like, I have all these speed bumps so that I don't have to go all the way down, you know, and I keep growing. And sometimes it still sucks, and I know how to continue to let it suck, and I know that it gets better, and I just feel so, I feel glad to be alive, you know, like this shitty, stressful days at work, and I can roll with it now, you know what I'm saying? I don't know, you know, I have good friends. I don't have a lot of money, you know. I've had a lot of money in recovery and like been miserable, and now I'm like paying this ridiculous rent here in Oakland. I don't know what the hell, why you guys think you could charge that amount of rent out here? I have no idea, but I just pay the shit, and I just keep letting life and letting go and letting like sort of the steps guide me, you know. I still check in, you know, because I know that my brain is broken, you know, and it will go back into life is miserable mode if I don't like stack the deck in the favor of my own gratitude, right? Intentionally, like force that, you know. So I feel real glad to be here, and thanks for letting me share.
All right, my name is Joe Sizer. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Miles, for asking me to speak tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak in the AA meeting. Big shoes to fill, following Kyle. Kyle did a beautiful job of what the book suggests, of sharing in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I think very often we confuse that and end up talking a lot about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's fine, but the problem that I sometimes have with that is my it doesn't always match up with your it. And it's easier for me to look for the differences between my it and your it. But when you do what Kyle did, which is talk about what we're like and how it felt before and what happened and how it feels to be in my skin today, I've never found any differences there. I can always connect and I can always relate on that level. So thank you very much. And I'll try and follow suit. So I like to say I was a social drinker until about the age of 12. And the reason I say that is because I was the youngest of six kids. My father was a drunk. My mother was, I think, a sometimes Al-Anon attendee. But according to her, it wasn't called Al-Anon then. It was called Neurotics Anonymous, if you can believe that. But my father never drank at home, except when he was stuck at home with the family on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he couldn't go out to the tavern, so he would put up some wine for us to have, you know, a glass of wine with dinner, which I know now is just his way of making sure that he had something to drink when he was trapped at home with the family. But they would give me a little splash of wine with a little bit of club soda, make me a little spritzer, and so I could pretend I was one of the grown-ups at Thanksgiving and Christmas. But then when I was 12, my next-door neighbor had an open house for one of their daughters' high school graduation. And her younger brother and myself and a couple other kids ended up in the basement. It was in southwestern Minnesota, rural Minnesota. So all the homes had basements. Not many houses out here have basements. But they had a fully stocked bar in this finished basement. And we got into that liquor and played a drinking game called Up and Down the River, a card game. I don't know if any of you ever played that. And I lost or won, depending on how you look at it. But I sampled everything in that bar until I came across something that I actually liked the flavor of, and that was creme de menthe. Which makes sense if you're 12, right? Scotch and, you know, vodka and gin and all that stuff was absolutely disgusting. But creme de menthe was like candy, right? So anyway, we got very drunk and then went out riding our bikes or something. And I blacked out that first time I got drunk. I passed out that first time I got drunk. And I threw up that first time I got drunk. The trifecta. And at one point in the night, as I was getting sick, I was afraid that I was going to die. And at one point the next morning, I was afraid that I was going to live. And I was so terrified that I actually went to my mother and I told her what had happened, sort of. I lied and said that I drank a lot of the punch, and the punch must have been spiked. But, you know, being married to a drunk, she wasn't too worried about me, so she just kind of told me to go sleep it off. But anyway, what was truly memorable and significant about that first drunk is up until then, even at the age of 12, I was exquisitely comfortable in my own uncomfortable in my own skin. And circumstantially, didn't really have any reason to be. I mean, yeah, my dad was a drunk and, you know, whatever, but I actually had a pretty good upbringing. And especially compared to a lot of your stories that I've heard in the rooms over the years since, right? I was never physically abused. I was never emotionally or verbally abused. We always had a roof over our head. We always had food to eat, right? I mean, I didn't have any, you know, circumstantial reason to be so uncomfortable, but I was. And for me, that's alcoholism, is I was terrified from my earliest memory. Terrified of life, terrified of other people, and felt less than, right? And this is my narrative, or it was my narrative for most of my childhood. We grew up in a neighborhood in this tiny little town, about 4,000 people. We had two stoplights in town, about a dozen bars, and about an equal number of churches, so it kind of evened out. But this one little neighborhood where I grew up was where all the doctors and dentists lived. And so I felt very much less than, because my father was blue collar, worked for the railroad. And we weren't poor per se, but we never really had any extras, and I always wore hand-me-down clothes from my older siblings and stuff. And I looked at, you know, the kids in my neighborhood, and they always had newer and nicer and better stuff than I did, and went on better vacations and had lake homes and all this kind of stuff. So that was my narrative I told myself about how, you know, we weren't as good as they were, because they had money and means and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that first time that I actually drank enough to feel it, it was literally like drinking a magic potion straight out of Harry Potter. And it completely transformed me and absolutely transformed my outlook on life. And I went from being scared and timid and very, very unsure of myself and absolutely feeling less than pretty much everybody to being better, smarter, taller, funnier, faster, good. I mean, it fixed everything that was wrong with me. And so even though I had a really horrible experience in terms of the blacking out and the passing out and the throwing up and a horrific hangover and all that, I had a conscious thought, I can't wait to do this again. And I then drank like a pig for the next 10 years. And the way I drank was, once I started drinking, which was nearly daily for those 10 years, I didn't stop until I was physically incapacitated and I could no longer make this motion with my arm. Right? The keg running dry was certainly not a good reason to stop drinking. The tavern closing wasn't a reason to stop drinking. The party ending and everybody being kicked out wasn't a reason to stop drinking. We drunks are very resourceful people, and if we're still thirsty, we're going to find more booze, right? So that's how I drank for the next 10 years. I was a senior in high school, and one of you came into the school and gave this talk about alcoholism. And that was the first time I learned that everyone didn't black out when they drank. I just thought that was part and parcel with drinking. You drink, you get drunk, you wake up the next morning, and you've got time missing, right? So anyway, fast forward, I drank like that all through college and didn't really have any circumstances. I didn't really have any consequences as a result of my drinking. I didn't lose a job. I didn't flunk out of school. In fact, I didn't even get bad grades. I graduated summa cum laude. Everything circumstantially was fine. But I graduated college, and I moved in with my older brother, and he was 90 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was on fire. I mean, it was disgusting. He was one of these AA cheerleaders that wanted to sober up the entire planet. And I was his first family project, right? But we sat down literally the afternoon of the day that I moved in, And he basically told me his story and somehow did a Jedi mind trick on me and convinced me to go to a meeting with him that night, which I agreed to, and then spent the next several hours trying to figure out how to get out of and couldn't come up with anything plausible. So I go to this meeting, and I think they were talking about the fourth step, which made no sense to me whatsoever. It was a real small meeting when it came to me. I didn't say I was an alcoholic. I said, my name is Joe, and I'm scared. And that was true, because what I had revealed to my brother was I was afraid that I was going crazy. I thought I was losing my mind. And I knew that I drank like a pig, but it literally never, ever occurred to me that the two might have anything to do with each other. And his sponsor and my brother took me out for coffee after the meeting, and his sponsor 12-stepped me. Good old-fashioned pitch. He talked about what we are like, and he described me as though he had been reading my mail for years, even though I just met him 30 minutes before. And while I certainly didn't want to be an alcoholic, there was a certain amount of relief at the prospect, because in my mind, that was somehow better than being certifiably insane, which is what I thought I was. Turns out they're not mutually exclusive, but that's another topic. I then spent the next 6 weeks really not wanting to be an alcoholic and not going to any more meetings, but not drinking. So, oh, and I forgot. My sobriety date is June 1st, 1988. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I talk to and meet with my sponsor on a regular basis. I've worked the steps numerous times and continue to do so. I sponsor a bunch of guys and take them through the steps. I think that's most of the stuff we're supposed to say. I don't remember. Anyway, my brother's next project was our father. And my mother announced to me on the day that I graduated from college that she was going to leave him, finally. So she waited until the youngest was fully out of the nest and literally that day said, I'm done, right? And my siblings and I were all like, finally, it's about time, right? But my brother was worried that it would send our father on a bender that would kill him, which was a very real possibility. So he orchestrated and we all participated in a family intervention on Father's Day, June 19th, 1988. And he agreed to go to treatment. So he goes into treatment. 3 weeks after that, I show up for family week. And after the first day or two, one of the counselors pulls me aside and says, what's your deal? What do you mean? He says, you're really pissed off and you really don't want to be here. And I said, no, I'm fine. Which is the standard response for a drunk when you're asked what's going on, right? But anyway, long story short, he figured out that I might have some issues of my own. Took me into his office, administered a questionnaire. I've never seen or heard of this one before or since. It wasn't the standard 20 questions. It was like 44. And I was pretty honest, and I think I got a 42, because I always tested well. And he said afterward, he said, we typically say if you score 5 or higher, you might have a problem with alcohol. And even that didn't really get through. What got me was he said, let me ask you a question. He said, would you find it easier to just not drink ever again? Or to have 2 drinks a day, every day, no more, but no less, for the rest of your life. And I physically slumped in my chair. And it was that moment that I knew that alcohol was my master, because I knew that there was absolutely no possibility whatsoever for me to drink 2 drinks a day, no more, no less. So I started going to meetings. Didn't necessarily go to a great meeting, and didn't get a sponsor, and I listened to what some well-intentioned people told me, which was, you know, just don't drink and go to meetings. And if that's what you're doing and it's working for you, great. For me, it was a good way to end up dead, because 2 years of that And I was given real serious consideration to taking a hard left in front of an oncoming truck on my way to work in the morning. And I like to say that I got so desperate that I did something really, really crazy, and I started going through the steps. Now, I didn't have a sponsor, but I just followed the book as best I could. I couldn't figure out the fourth step out of the book for the life of me. And I didn't figure out until years later that the reason it stymied me so badly is because it is so unbelievably simple. And I was trying to, like we do, try and complicate it and try and read between the lines and try and figure out what the angle was, right? There's no angle. It's really simple and straightforward. But anyway, I did a fifth step with a Catholic priest. And I will forever be grateful to him for being willing to give of his time and do that. But it didn't really do it for me. I didn't really get any relief from that. But I got enough relief from going through the steps on my own to at least breathe a little bit. And then something happened that was absolutely life-changing. I was at a meeting. I moved. And so I was going to a new meeting, and this kid came up to me after the meeting and asked me to sponsor him. And I had no business agreeing to sponsor this kid because I didn't have a sponsor myself. But probably my ego walked me into it and said, yeah, sure, of course, I'll sponsor you, right? And it was the single best thing that ever happened to me because he started dragging me around to meetings all over Minneapolis and actually found one on his own and then brought me back to it. And it was called the Central Pacific Group, and it was a spinoff of the Pacific Group down in Southern California. And it's this huge speaker meeting with 300 people, 350 people, all having a blast in recovery. And I walked in and somebody greeted me at the door and shook my hand and walked me over to the coffee and the cookies and chatted with me for a while. And I'd been going to meetings for 2 years in Minneapolis, and I had never felt more welcome and a part of than I did in that meeting that night. So I ended up getting one of the co-founders, who's a couple, a man and wife, husband and wife, who started that meeting, Ed and Nancy. I asked Ed to be my sponsor. Ed took me through the steps again. I got a commitment, very strong sponsorship ethic and commitments. Commitments were such a big deal at that meeting, sponsor-directed, that we had to make up positions in order to have a job for everybody, right? And so, for example, one of the commitments was to bring extra rolls of toilet paper in case the bathrooms in the church ran out of toilet paper. We were never going to run out of toilet paper, but we would make up jobs so that people could have a commitment. And the significance of that, if you're new or sort of hanging around the periphery here, is that was when I first felt like I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was when I first felt like I truly joined Alcoholics Anonymous and I wasn't sitting on the edge. Because prior to that, my deal was I'd go to meetings, but I'd get there right about the time it started, maybe a minute late, right, so that I didn't have to actually talk to any of you. And then we'd hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer at the end. We always said the Lord's Prayer back then. And I'd stand there for about 37 seconds, part of me desperately wishing that someone would come up and say hi to me, and the other part of me absolutely dreading the possibility. And when I finally couldn't stand that tension anymore, I'd bolt for the door and I'd go home, and I'd feel 10 times more miserable and alone once I got home than I had before I went. And I did that for 2 years. This group, because I joined and I got a commitment and participated, changed all of that. And my commitment was perfect. I was the butt cane man. I brought all the coffee cans to put out front for the smokers. And once a month at that meeting, the last Thursday of the month, all the people who had service commitments would get what we called juice, which is the secretary would list everybody by name and thank them for their commitments. And whenever they said me and that I was the butt can man, I'd get this huge uproarious round of applause from 350 people, right? So huge ego boost. And then I'd have to go put 12 stinky, smelly, disgusting coffee cans full of cigarette butts in the back of my car, which levels your ego like nothing else, right? So it was this great roller coaster. But anyway, so I did that for a couple years and then was recruited to go to work for a company down near Monterey. So I moved out to California. where I did what I had been taught to do, which is I went to meetings and I stuck my hand out and I got phone numbers and I plugged in. And throughout all of this, I was just like Bill writes about in the book. I felt like I was rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. And my life became better than I ever imagined it could be. My sponsor, I don't know if I mentioned this, My sponsor took me through the steps again. My fifth step with him was dramatically different than it was with the priest. And I'm not dissing the priest. The priest was awesome and wonderful. But I didn't know the priest, and I knew that I'd never see the priest again, so it was kind of easy. I respected my sponsor, and I loved my sponsor, and what he thought of me mattered to me. And so when he not only didn't reject me when I told him my deepest, darkest, most shameful memories that I didn't ever want to tell anybody, but he actually sort of doubled down on me and told me some of his stuff, and it actually brought us closer. That was life-changing, because I took all that stuff that I was spent all my life trying to hide and cover up, and I laid it out on the table to somebody, and they kind of looked at it and said, yeah, that's not bad. Let me tell you with some of my stuff, right? So anyway, moved to California, got plugged in, got a bunch of sponsors. I ended up sponsoring a bunch of guys in Minneapolis, got a bunch of sponsors out here. It's been a big part of most of my recovery. Met and married my wife. We had a kid. Ended up having two kids, but things really kind of went off the rails with our first. Life just got really, really hard. And which is no different than life for anybody else. I'm not saying that I was unique or special or anything. It's just my career was taken off, and to have a demanding job and, you know, small kids and sleep deprived and all that, I drifted away from AA and ended up going on essentially a dry drunk for several years. And that coincided with when I went to that first meeting with my brother. He said beforehand, he said, now you're going to hear a bunch of God shit. He said, don't worry about it. Because we were raised Catholic and, you know, we were recovering Catholics and all that stuff. I was an altar boy, the whole deal. And I'm really glad that he told me that, because that would have been enough to, you know, send me out the door. And I love what we say, which is that God drives us out of the rooms and booze drives us back in. And we sort of ping pong back and forth until we finally reconcile what it says in We Agnostics, which is to live a spiritual life or to die a painful alcoholic death are not easy alternatives to face, right? So I ended up having what I felt was a close personal relationship with a God of my understanding. It was a very traditional God of Abraham, Judeo-Christian, right? And that was from a priest when my father was in treatment. I was there for family, who gave a talk on spirituality, which I thought, you know, how's that going to work? What does a priest know about spirituality? But he was great because he was a drunk. His name was George, and he talked about a personal relationship with a God of his understanding. And the example he gave was, he said that he thanked God for green lights on his way to work in the morning, and he cussed at him for red ones. And he said, he doesn't fall out of the sky. He laughs at me, and he says, well, George, I'm not the one that overslept. And so that was literally the beginning of my spiritual journey in recovery, as I started thanking God for green lights and cussing at him for red ones. But it led to what I felt was a very deep personal relationship with this Judeo-Christian God. And then it stopped. And I don't know why, and I don't know what got different, but I went from having what I thought was a really strong spiritual connection to there was just nobody on the other end of the line. And I spent the next several years, what I describe as wandering in the desert. And in hindsight, I realized that I was trying to intellectualize it. And we can't. There is no intellectual answer to that. And so thankfully, it took a long time, but I finally sort of came full circle, right? Because that first sponsor, his way of telling me to get around that or deal with that is, he said, I want you to get in bed, well, get on your knees and pray. That was it. He said, get on your knees, stretch it over your bed, face down, and pray to your sheets. Right? So I don't want you to worry about if there's a God or if there's not a God or if God's listening or whatever. Just take the action. Just go through the motions. So after this several years of dry drunk and wandering in the desert and spiritual dryness, I came full circle back to that, and I just surrendered to the mystery, and I stopped trying to figure it out. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And so today, every single morning, and I've been doing this for a lot of years now, I pray every single day. That's how I start my day, is with prayer and 30 minutes of meditation. And I say the surrender prayer, which my sponsor taught me, which is simply, God, I give up. I'll do whatever you want me to do today. The third step prayer, the Lord's Prayer, and the prayer of St. Francis, or the 11th step prayer, to a God that I'm quite certain doesn't exist. And it doesn't matter. Saying the prayers and taking the actions works, even if I don't believe what it is I'm supposedly praying to. So anyway, I should probably speed this up. What time do I stop?
You have until 8:55.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
When I spoke at that big speaker meeting, 350 people, my sponsor at one point yelled out from the crowd, he said, "You better get sober," because I got a little lost in my drunk luck. So anyway, I ended up in this dry drunk, and I was still kind of going to meetings, but not very often, and I was pretty full of fear and resentment, and had sponsors that I would talk to, but they kind of co-signed my bullshit rather than call me on it. And it was not good. And then after 15 years on the Monterey Peninsula, the company that I worked for decided they wanted me in Chicago, so I packed up the family and we moved to Chicago. And within a few weeks, first 30 days of getting to Chicago, my wife announced that she wanted a separation. And then, shortly after that, this company that I'd been with for 15 years and just moved across country for fired me. And it's kind of a long story, and I used to say I got laid off, which technically I kind of did because I got a severance package, but truth is, they fired me. And so, circumstantially, the wheels completely fell off in my life. Because shortly after that, my wife decided that her and the kids were moving back to California. And I ended up getting a job with Sears Financial Services, so I was kind of stuck in Chicago. So spent the next 3 years 2,000 miles away from my kids. So that was honestly a more difficult and painful bottom for me than whatever bottom I had that brought me into AA in the first place. And I'm sitting in a meeting, a Saturday morning, 6:30 a.m. meeting, one morning, talking about it, probably crying about it, and certainly not for the first time, probably for the who knows how many weeks in a row. And this one guy, Dan, pulls me aside after, he actually asked me this during the meeting. He said, "Joe, let me ask you a question." He said, "If the circumstances in your life don't get any different than they are right now, are you going to be okay?" And that really pissed me off, because that was a really shitty question to ask, because the answer was no, right? My being okay was entirely contingent upon the circumstances of my life, and the circumstances of my life were not at all how I wanted them to be at that moment. So he invited me to join a group of men, an AA group, that some of you may be familiar with. It's a men's meeting format called Dignitaries of Sympathy. And the way it's described to me is a group of men who love each other enough to tell each other the truth. And so I attended that meeting. I got a sponsor in that meeting. Unlike most meetings that have a format that expressly prohibits crosstalk, this format actually requires it. And every single week, someone would leave with a resentment, and a handful of times it almost got physical. Because I don't know if you know this, but drunks don't like getting called on their shit. But that group of men loved me back together and helped me learn, without question, the most valuable spiritual lesson of my entire life and certainly of my entire recovery, which is, it's not about the circumstances. I can be okay, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, regardless of my circumstances. It's not about how much money's in my checking account. It's not about what kind of job I have, right? The book says, job or no job, wife or no wife, right? And most of us, myself included, do what I call, we play the if only as soon as game, right? And we tell ourselves these lies that, you know, yeah, life kind of sucks right now, but I'll be okay as soon as this happens. Mm-hmm. Or I'll be okay if only this happens, right? As soon as I make this amount of money, or I have this kind of a job, or I have a relationship, or I no longer have a relationship, or whatever the case may be, right? And the problem with that is, even if we can manage better, like the book says, right, and bring about all those circumstances, by the time we do, we've got a new list, right? Because, well, yeah, okay, I thought $100,000 a year and salary would make me happy, but it turns out I really need two, right? Or, you know, yeah, I really wanted to be in a relationship, but now that I'm in a relationship, I think I really want to be single again, or whatever, right? So if any of you can relate to that or connect with that and feel like, yeah, you're kind of stuck around your circumstances and you want to chat after the meeting about how do we get okay regardless of our circumstances, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. But I want to spend a few minutes talking about the steps because I'm a huge proponent of the steps. Steps have saved me. Steps have more than saved me. The steps have given me an absolutely beautiful, wonderful life. Like I said, I spent those first couple of years just not drinking and going to meetings. And if you're a hard drinker or a problem drinker, but not a real alcoholic, that may be fine, right? And you're absolutely welcome here. Tradition 3 clearly states that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So if that's you, I'm glad you're here. Drink the coffee. Have some cookies. It's all good, right? But if you're a real alcoholic, you are, as I am, restless, irritable, and discontented until we can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes with a few drinks. And if I could do that and stop after two, like that counselor asked me if I could, I'd still be doing that today, right? If I could just take the edge off, just let a little air out of the balloon and stop, I'd be doing that still. But the problem is, for a real alcoholic, once we have those couple of drinks, then the phenomenon of craving kicks in and all bets are off, right? I'm going to keep drinking until I can't do this anymore. And that's when all the fun of, you know, jails and car wrecks and DUIs and all that stuff starts to happen. So if I could just not drink, that would work too. Except alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was my solution to life. So you take away my solution, alcohol, and you don't give me a new one, and I very quickly become suicidal, homicidal, or I got to pick up a drink again. So that's where the steps come in for me. Is, and this is the way I describe it to the guys that I work with. It's been my experience and my observation that every drunk I've ever known has a tape playing in the back of our head that says something to the effect of, you know you're really a worthless piece of shit. And it's just a matter of time before everybody else figures that out too. So all my character defects are nothing more than an attempt to prevent you from discovering that. Even though I know that that's really what's going on. And I can get nasty, if need be, in order to keep you from seeing what a worthless piece of shit I know that I really am. And what the steps have done for me in my life is they allow me to get honest with that instead of trying to cover it up and hide it and bury it. And they allow me to relate to you because you're loving enough and compassionate enough and understanding enough, like my first sponsor was, to say, yeah, I've done that stuff too. It's okay. And then I do steps 8 and 9, and I make my living amends. And that first sponsor, this was absolutely brilliant. He described living amends, or amends this way. He said, when we amend the U.S. Constitution, we change its meaning by adding to it. Nothing ever gets taken out, right? It still says in our U.S. Constitution that a slave is 3/5 of a man. It's still in there. Always will be. But we amended it with the 13th and 14th Amendments to change the meaning of that. by adding to it. So that's how we make amends. Because when a drunk says, I'm sorry, it roughly translates as, I'm going to do it again. Right? So a simple verbal amends of, you know, apologizing to someone that we've hurt a couple thousand times, they probably don't really want to hear it, right? So we make living amends and change how we show up in our relationships on a consistent basis over a long period of time, right? 10 miles in, 10 miles out. And in doing so, we get freedom. Freedom from that shame, freedom from that guilt, freedom from the feeling that we have to. You ever been in a supermarket and you see somebody you recognize, but you really don't want them to see you? And so you duck down a different aisle and, you know, avoid them. Or your phone rings and it's somebody you really don't want to talk to, whether it's a bill collector or somebody else you owe money to, or just somebody that you were an asshole to and you don't, you know, you're trying to avoid. After we've made our nights of amends, we don't have to do any of that anymore. We're free people. And we can go anywhere and we can answer the phone when it rings and we don't have to hide out. And through that whole process, that tape in the back of our head, at a minimum, the volume goes way down and the frequency of the loop diminishes. And it's certainly been my experience for periods. It doesn't necessarily always stay this way, but for periods where it gets turned off completely. And we're able to be here now and live in peace and practice these principles, which are love and service. That's all it is love and service. And give it away. And that's what I try to do today. And I'm not perfect at it, but I'm incredibly grateful to be here and to be sober and to have an opportunity on a daily basis to do that to the best of my ability. Thank you very much.